At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It has been a raucous season of presidential politics already. Maybe in the long run, that'll turn out well for American politics. Bring out the voters, shake up the platforms. But it has also meant there are a lot of candidates who are having trouble getting heard. One of them is former governor of Maryland, former mayor of Baltimore, Democrat Martin O'Malley. He's been tough on what he calls racist hate in the GOP and on his own party, rigging the process he charged last weekend for Hillary Clinton. Today he joins us. This hour on Point, we talk with presidential hopeful Democratic candidate Martin O'Malley. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know Martin O'Malley's record, his vision for the country? What's your question for this presidential hopeful? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org. Or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. He was in Minneapolis last weekend, letting it rip before the Democratic National Committee. First, on the Republicans and what he decried as Democratic Party silence on what he sees as the worst of it.
The Republicans stand before the nation. They malign our president's record of achievements. They denigrate women and immigrant families. They double down on trickle down and they tell their false story. And we respond with crickets, tumbleweeds, a cynical move to delay and limit our own party debates.
Crickets, tumbleweeds, I don't know what Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton would have to say about that, but Martin O'Malley there in Minneapolis said the process in the Democratic side of the aisle has been rigged in the campaign process, campaign season.
This sort of rigged process has never been attempted before. Whose decree is this exactly? Where did it come from? To what end? For what purpose? What national or party interest does this decree serve? How does this help us tell the story of the last 8 years of democratic progress?
Rigged for whom, he was asked. Hillary? Yes, said Martin O'Malley. Later in this hour, we'll turn to two big national political reporters, Howard Fineman and Lisa Lera, for a roundup of the week's campaign news. But first, joining me from his campaign headquarters in Baltimore, fresh back from Iowa, is former governor, former mayor, and now candidate in the Democratic Party's primary race, Martin O'Malley. Governor O'Malley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We want to get into the guts of your agenda, your platform, but first to your big push there in Minneapolis and your critique. First, that the Democratic process, party process, is rigged this season. How so?
Yeah, they're trying to make it undemocratic by having as few debates as possible. Never before has this happened. And my message was that we need to be putting our ideas and our candidates before the American people. Otherwise, the only party that's being heard is the Republican Party, which today is led by the carnival barker, Donald Trump, who says hateful things and racist things about whole groups of Americans based on their ethnic background. So we need to do better as a party. We need to step up, you know, to tell Iowa we can only have one debate this year before the caucuses, to tell New Hampshire only one debate for New Hampshire, and then they cynically schedule it at the height of Christmas shopping season so as few people will watch it as possible. This isn't how the Democratic Party is supposed to operate. This was a decree that came at the prerogative of the chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and when I laid it before the DNC, those remarks got a standing ovation. The members of the Democratic National Committee actually agreed with me that we need to have more debates, not fewer. We owe it to the country.
Too few debates and too late, you say, Governor. You say rigged. Rigged for who?
Rigged for the inevitable frontrunner this year. Look, it is not unusual for party relationships to try to accommodate, shall we say, whoever the established leader of frontrunner is in any given year. That's happened before, but never before have they told us if you participate in unsanctioned debates, you will be barred from attending any of the official DNC debates. And that's never happened before. There was a motion from one of the members, I believe from the Virgin Islands, that after this got out, where he started asking the chair and wanted to put forward a resolution. He was quickly gaveled out of order, and the benediction was brought on to close the meeting. But I think you're going to see, Tom, state after state, especially these early states, who take their responsibility as the first in the nation caucus or the first in the nation primary very, very seriously. I think you're going to see them rise up and demand that this decree from the chair be reconsidered and that we have more than just one debate in Iowa and one debate in New Hampshire.
Governor O'Malley, you go after the Republican field for denigrating people, for trickle-down economics, and you charge that the Democratic field has responded with crickets. Silence. Really? I mean, Bernie Sanders is out there. Hillary Clinton is out there. You're out there. Crickets? Silence?
Yeah, no debates. Tom, 24 million people tuned in to watch the first two rounds of the Republican debates. They're going to be doing another debate shortly. It's one thing to have candidates out there, and I'm not having trouble getting my message out when I'm going town to town through Iowa or New Hampshire. In fact, we've gone from 1% to 3% to 7% and now 40% name recognition now in Iowa. But it's the country at large. We are not offering debates. We are not putting forward our ideas, and people are tuning in instead to the falsehoods put out by the Republican Party. The notion of trickle-down economics, concentrate wealth at the top, remove regulation everywhere, keep wages low. That's not a good message for us to leave uncountered. We need to call them out. We need to push back on this hate speech that's coming out of the Republican Party that most of their candidates haven't the spine to push back on. So we need to. And the good news about us when we start having debates is instead of putting out hateful stuff about immigrants or rolling back women's rights or workers' rights, we'll be asking one another what we can do for our country, what ideas we have to make college more affordable, to make wages go up now that we've put our country on a path to create more jobs every month. We need to get wages to go up for families instead of flatlining or going down. These are the things we need to talk about, not emails. Those are legitimate questions from the press, but when our party becomes branded by questions daily about what did Hillary Clinton know about emails and when did she know it? What the hell does that have to do with the primary concern that most families have around their kitchen table of how they're going to make ends meet, how they're going to give their kids a better quality of life with more opportunity and greater health?
Former governor of Maryland, mayor of Baltimore, Martin O'Malley is with us. He's running for president. You may have heard, you may not. It's been a battle to get his message out, but he is on it. He's been just recently in Iowa, laying it down hard with the DNC over the weekend. Joins us today from Baltimore. And, Governor, we've got callers for you. Max, in Jamestown, New York, you are on the air with Martin O'Malley.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Governor.
Hey, Max.
I'm a millennial and I guess a politically active one at that. And it seems as though a lot of people, a lot of my friends from college, we seem to be generating a lot of buzz about Bernie Sanders through social media. And I think that that social media push has been really reflective in polls. He's been gaining a lot of ground, especially against Hillary Clinton and Iowa. And whereas I agree with your point that there aren't as many debates in the Democratic Party as there should be, Why is Bernie Sanders able to get his name out there and make so many, you know, so much ground? Whereas you are, you know, not doing that well in the polls. And I think I'm, for one, I'm curious to hear what you have to say. I guess would you have a response to that as to why Bernie has been getting so much more attention?
It's a great question, Max. Governor of Vermont is broken through like crazy. Governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, why not you? Bernie's done it.
Actually, he was a senator from Vermont.
Excuse me.
Yeah, that's okay. Here's my theory. I believe that in the summer, if you look at the history of our presidential selection process, the candidate who's peaking and doing very well the summer before is rarely ever the candidate who's in the stretch or emerges on caucus night. What's going on right now in our country is that while our country's recovered in the sense that we're creating more jobs every month than we lose, 70% of American families are earning the same or less than they were 12 years ago. And there's a lot of anger, therefore, out there, frustration, deep discontent with the established leaders of both parties. So the candidates that most represent that and symbolize for people the anger at the establishment are the candidates that peak in the summer. But rarely do the parties ever nominate angry for president.
Is it possible that you just haven't kept up with the political temper of the country, Governor? Bernie Sanders is doing very well right now. He's almost neck and neck with Hillary Clinton in some polls. If that anger is so hot now that that's what it takes to be out there and really be in the game, is that where you've got to be?
It's interesting. A guy came out to see me in Iowa City, and he said, you know, I've been following you. I'm hugely impressed with all of the progressive things you got done as governor, with the way you govern. And he said, I was coming out to tell you that you need to say more outrageous things, but after hearing you, I think you need to keep doing what you're doing, because what we need is a president, not somebody that just gives angry speeches. And so that's what I intend to do. I've never found that anger, fear, or division, Tom, are very helpful to building up a country or to rebuilding and making real in our time the American dream.
A lot of
that's
serious potential voters are lining up with Bernie Sanders. You call him a protest candidate. Are you so sure?
Do you remember Alan Cranston?
Yes, like others vaguely, yes.
Yeah, Alan Cranston did great the summer before. I'm running for president. I'm not running for angry. And so I intend to put forward, as I did 2 weeks ago in Iowa, and where we've moved, by the way, from 1% to 3% to 5% to 7%, and now 40% name recognition, I'm going to follow the tried and true path that many other candidates, not very well known in the country, until they made their case to the Iowa caucus goers, have followed, people like Jimmy Carter and others. And so I laid out 15 strategic goals to move our country forward, to rebuild the American dream, to make wages go up and not down, to make college debt-free as an option for every American family. And then today I'm rolling out a proposal for national service, which will allow us to reach the strategic goal of cutting youth unemployment in half in the next 3 years by a greatly expanding national service, AmeriCorps, doubling the size of the Peace Corps, and also linking these to greater Pell Grants to make it connect with our drive for debt-free college.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former Baltimore Mayor and Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley about his run for the White House for the Democratic Party nomination for the U.S. presidency. Governor O'Malley joins us from Baltimore. He's just back from Iowa, where he has been whacking away. It's been hard to break through. He's been in single digits, but he is out there working on it. You can join us this hour. Are you still looking for your candidate? Could this be it, Martin O'Malley? Or are you waiting for Biden, going for Trump, Clinton, Sanders? And of course, a lot of attention on Baltimore today, where there's a preliminary hearing for those six police officers who have been charged there in the death of Freddie Gray. There were protests even before the hearings began there outside the courthouse.
Tell the truth and stop the violence.
Freddie Gray didn't have to die.
Tell the truth and stop the violence.
Tell the truth and stop the violence. We'll look at that. Governor O'Malley, how is your message different from Hillary Clinton's, from Bernie Sanders?
It comes down to one word, and that is results. Many of us will profess to have progressive goals and progressive values, but only one of us has 15 years of executive experience actually accomplishing progressive things. Among them, forging a new consensus to make Maryland the first state to pass a living wage, raising the minimum wage, passing marriage equality, the DREAM Act, passing comprehensive gun safety legislation. All of these things are the accomplishments that an executive who is skilled at bringing people together and forging a new consensus is able to achieve. So I'm the only candidate in this race that not only will make progressive promises, but actually has a record of executive achievements getting things done.
Sharon in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, you're on the air with Governor O'Malley.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Governor O'Malley, I have a question concerning your tenure as mayor of Baltimore, as well as a subsequent governor of Maryland. During your tenure, some of the policies and funding cuts that you instituted indirectly or directly contributed to the conditions that led up to what happened to Freddie Gray and other policing policies there. Given what we know now, I would like to know, what would you do differently, and what changes do you propose be made so that we can remedy the conditions that led up to and that are still in place in inner cities like Baltimore in your state of Maryland?
Governor O'Malley, was your zero tolerance policy in retrospect, despite how it brought crime down, was it a mistake? Did it set the stage for the riots in Baltimore, the death of Freddie Gray?
No, I do not believe that it did. In fact, Sharon mentioned funding cuts. We did not cut funding. In fact, I increased drug treatment funding by more than any other mayor in our history. And I also greatly improved police and community relations by doing the things that work to reduce police-involved shootings, by the way, to the three lowest years on record in Baltimore. We gave the Civilian Review Board its own detectives so that they could follow cases. And I laid out a criminal justice reform agenda at the Urban League that talked about the things we need to do as a nation in order to improve police-community relations, reduce and improve the integrity of forces, and also the openness and transparency.
But you've got serious critics who say that during your tenure, relations with the African-American community in Baltimore and police reached their nadir. You had a number of arrests equal to one-sixth of the population of Baltimore at the height of it, and people said that the community suffered from that despite crime coming down. No regrets about that, even given everything we've seen?
Tom, there is always more work to do, and every mayor has his critics. But let me say this: if what I was doing at that time was not making our city better, why did 88% of the people reelect me 5 years later? In other words, there will always be critics. There is no effective leader that does not have his critics. But if you look at the facts, I mean, by the time I was done being governor, we had reduced our incarceration rate to 20-year lows, even as we had reduced our violent crime level to 30-year lows. We also closed the largest and most dangerous and notorious prison 52 days into my tenure as governor. I decriminalized the possession of small amounts of marijuana. I restored voting rights to 52,000.
But zero tolerance
people
is in pretty bad odor these days. Would you recommend that as the way forward for policing in this country, looking at out from 2015?
No, and in fact, what I laid forward was a criminal justice reform agenda that builds upon the things that we've learned that work to save and redeem lives, like reentry programs, goal-oriented community policing. You threw out a number there that said that I had arrested one out of six citizens in the city of Baltimore.
A number equivalent to.
Right. But the insinuation is that I arrested, that it's equivalent to one out of six people.
The number was equivalent to one out of six. It was equivalent to.
Well, you've made your point, and the point that I'm trying to share with you is this, that in our city, we had an election about all of these issues, and there is no candidate running for president that has tended this wound of violent crime, race, and law enforcement as consistently as I have over these last 23 years of public service. We had whole sections of our city, mostly poor neighborhoods, that were under a 24/7 drug dealer siege, and the voters voted to have that siege lifted. That's what we did.
Ten
police officers gave their lives lifting that siege and putting Baltimore on a path to achieve the biggest reduction of crime of any major city in America. And along the way, we actually improved police-community relations. We actually beefed up our civilian review. We did 100 reverse integrity stings a year. And because of that, not only was I elected and reelected with overwhelming numbers from our poorest neighborhoods as mayor, I also enjoyed huge amount of support from those very same neighborhoods when I ran not once but twice for governor.
Governor, can we talk about immigration? Our time is short. You've been very critical of Republicans and Donald Trump. You've called Republicans out for racist hate. What would you do with the country's immigration challenge?
I would forge a new consensus to pass comprehensive immigration reform so that 11 million of our neighbors can be put on a path to full citizenship. I believe that having 11 million of our neighbors working oftentimes off the books and in an underground economy is bad for wages. In order to get wages to go up, we actually need to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And I would also extend further by executive action the number of persons that would be covered, as President Obama has done. I would cover even more people. I would eliminate this horrible policy of for-profit prisons, which I think is an outrage and bad public policy. I would apply due process to a much fuller extent in terms of ICE proceedings. And those are some of the things that I would do. I believe that our nation's made better every generation by the arrival of new American immigrants. And I believe we're selling our country short by not passing comprehensive immigration reform.
Governor, sadly, we have a hard out with you at half past. Hillary Clinton has faced a lot of trouble with these emails. You see them as a distraction. Will she remain a viable candidate? Joe Biden's looking at getting in. What do you see coming here? Is there an O'Malley path to the nomination? Does it require Hillary falling down, falling out?
I believe that the people of our country are looking for a new leader, and they're looking for a leader who actually can get things done. We know that we can't make our economy work again for all of us unless we can make our government work. The Democratic Party always looks to the future. Democratic Party is the party out of which our new leaders emerge. And I believe that that's going to happen this year. And if Vice President Biden wants to join this race, I'm sure if we are allowed to have debates, those debates would be helped and enriched by his lifetime of experience and wisdom in public service.
And Bernie Sanders, are you sure this is a protest candidate? You've got a lot of people who have dug in hard for him already.
Well, and that's great. Isn't it wonderful to have choices in the Democratic Party? I am a lifelong Democrat, and what I offer is 15 years of executive experience accomplishing progressive things with a economic record of success in my state, which not only maintained a AAA bond rating, but the highest median income in the country and the highest goals for minority and women business participation. So if we want to make our country better, we want to rebuild the American dream, we're going to have to accomplish things together again as a people. I'm the leader that can allow us to do that and can lead us forward.
Former Maryland Governor Democrat Martin O'Malley joining us there from Baltimore. Governor O'Malley, good luck, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks a lot.
It was not only Governor O'Malley in Minneapolis over the weekend. Last Friday, Hillary Clinton was there. She was asked what she would do about this country's 11 million undocumented immigrants. She said she supports comprehensive immigration reform and talked about some on the other side who want to deport those millions.
I find it the height of irony that a party which espouses small government would want to unleash a massive law enforcement effort, including perhaps National Guard and others, to go and literally pull people out of their homes and their workplaces, round them up, put them, I don't know, in buses, boxcars.
Hillary Clinton there, in effect, going after Donald Trump on immigration policy on Friday in Minneapolis. We've just been talking with former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. Of course, he is out there, low single digits, but swinging for the Democratic nomination. We'll see. We want to look at the wider field of candidates in both parties. With us right now to do that, from Washington, Howard Fineman is here, Global Editorial Director of the AOL Huffington Post Media Group. Howard Fineman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I apologize for that endlessly long title.
Yes, it is august. And from Washington, Lisa Lehrer is with us, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Lisa, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Let me just first put some of Governor O'Malley's points to the two of you. He said in Minneapolis over the weekend, and you heard him just now, that when the Republicans roll out their view of the world, and it's anathema to him, should be to Democrats, that the Democrats' response has been crickets, tumbleweeds, silence. We got Hillary Clinton there talking about boxcars and immigration. Is the governor onto something or not, Lisa?
Well, Hillary Clinton's certainly been spending a lot of time and energy attacking Republicans. She hasn't spent much time so far on her Democratic potential challengers. In fact, that's in part because she has a pretty strong lead right now, although we've seen that lead shrinking a little bit in Iowa and New Hampshire. The interesting thing will be if Joe Biden gets into the race. He's the big shadow on the Democratic side right now. If he gets in, we may see that change, and she may go more directly at some of the Democratic challengers. But there really isn't much of a reason for Hillary Clinton to go after Martin O'Malley. He hasn't been able to break out of single digits. Bernie Sanders is a much more significant threat to her. And the question will be how she deals with that as we get closer to the Iowa caucuses.
Howard Fineman, can you really call Bernie Sanders crickets, a man of silence on the GOP worldview?
He's the loudest Brooklyn-born cricket I've ever heard. No, I take Martin O'Malley's point in that I've been around long enough to get a sense of the rhythm of primary seasons, especially the Democratic one. And he has a point about protest candidates and people coming out of nowhere at the end and et cetera, et cetera. Don't forget, he started out with Gary Hart, so that's his template for things going back to 1984.
In the 80s, yeah.
But I think the world has changed since then. And listening to Martin O'Malley and looking at his website and reading his proposals and hearing how he's positioning himself, and looking at his record, which in an earlier day might have made him precisely that kind of person to come on at the very end and steal the Iowa caucuses, I have my doubts about that now, because I think the world has changed. I think the country's gotten much angrier. He says he wants to run for president, not angry. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of anger out there. The polls show it. The anecdotally, it shows it. And I think his record as mayor and governor, especially as mayor, which in an earlier day might have been a great calling card as a Caucasian elected in a majority black city and so on in mm-hmm. Baltimore, mm-hmm. the world on race has changed too. It's gotten much sharper and much more skeptical about the progress or lack thereof in the last 20 years. So I don't know. Bernie is of them. There's no question that Bernie's capturing the mood a lot better than anybody else on the Democratic side right now.
Well, look at Bernie Sanders. Lisa Lerer, take it over to the GOP for a minute. How do you explain Donald Trump's standing in the polls?
Well, I think it's to the point that Howard was making. There's a lot of anger out there, and it does feel, and the polls certainly indicate, that people are looking for someone outside of Washington, a non-politician type figure, and Donald Trump certainly fits that bill. The amazing thing to me is that, you know, you talk to a lot of people in Washington, a lot of very smart people, and no one's quite sure how this Trump story ends. Does he flame out? Does he stay in? People don't seem to think he gets the nomination. That feels somewhat unlikely, but no one knows quite how this works out. And, we also had another interesting development this week, which was that Ben Carson rose up in the polls in Iowa and became, you know, had a big boost. And I think that also speaks to this outsider sentiment. People are looking for someone who's not of Washington. And even though Bernie Sanders has been in Washington for quite a while, he also sort of has that feel about him. So I think that's part of why these folks are doing so well right now.
Howard Fineman, it's interesting. Donald Trump, who, you know, will talk big at the drop of a hat or a gold ingot or whatever it is. Ben Carson, who has moved up in a lot of these polls rather close to him in a few, who is sort of the quiet man. I mean, he speaks, but it's sort of the opposite of Trump delivery, Howard.
Yes, it's the opposite delivery. But if you listen carefully to what Dr. Ben Carson is saying, he's more systematically against the system in many ways than Donald Trump is. Don't forget that Donald Trump wants to keep Social Security, Medicare, protect the welfare state. He's talking about raising taxes on the wealthiest people. Donald Trump is a more ideologically confused, if more openly angry, outsider, whereas Ben Carson is the guy who talks softly but says some very, very sharp things in a gracious manner. And I think it's that combination that's appealing to some people, especially in Iowa. I mean, like Lisa, we've spent a lot of time mm-hmm. in Iowa, mm-hmm. and Iowans like nice. You know, they're earnest and they can be upset about things, but they like politeness, and it's a sort of Midwestern nice thing. And this doesn't surprise me that that Ben Carson is doing well.
Midwestern nice, but he is ready to bomb Arizona with drones,
yeah, exactly.
The caves of drug runners and smugglers there.
That's my point. He says it very calmly.
But Ben Carson, the other important thing about Iowa and Ben Carson is, unlike Donald Trump, Ben Carson comes from a more religious tradition.
Right,
and that's
right.
Important to Republicans in Iowa. They tend to be a little more devout. There's a large evangelical population. So that also could be a strong asset for him in that state.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking this hour with the former Maryland governor, Martin O'Malley, about his single digit so far in the polls effort to take the Democratic nomination and run for the White House. We're looking more broadly at the 2016 race now with Howard Fineman of AOL Huffington Post Media Group, also an analyst for NBC, Lisa Lehrer, national political reporter for the Associated Press, both with us from Washington, a lot of experience under their belts, and a big view of the campaign season. Surprises this time out, Donald Trump has surprised Bernie Sanders in just how well he's doing. The Trump surprise has taken the Jeb Bush campaign off guard, but they're punching back just recently. Yesterday, pulled the gloves off a little bit, released a new attack ad called The Real Donald Trump. This is from the Jeb Bush camp. It pulls together old Trump sound bites to show him all over the map ideologically with a New York state of mind. Watch out, Iowans. And a good friend of Hillary and Bill Clinton is presented here. Here's the Bush ad, The Real Donald Trump.
I live in New York. She lives in New York. And I've known her and her husband for years, and I really like them both a lot.
Do you identify more as a Democrat or a Republican?
Well, you'd be shocked if I said that in many cases I probably identify more as a Democrat.
Why are you a Republican?
I have no idea. I lived in New York City and Manhattan all my life, okay? So, you know, my views are a little bit different than if I lived in Iowa.
George Bush for something that will sound like anathema in Iowa and beyond. Donald Trump in Nashville on Saturday talked to reporters about whether or not he would pledge to stay in the GOP. He said so far that would certainly be the easiest path to victory, Donald said.
The Republican Party has been treating me very, very fairly. All I ask is fairness. And I'm leading in every poll by a lot. We're leading in every state by a lot. And a lot of things are really happening. In terms of victory, that would certainly be the best path to victory. And we're going to make a decision very soon, and I think a lot of people are going to be very happy.
Howard Fineman, where do you see this Trump bus going?
Well, I think he's going to take the pledge, and I think he's going to run as a Republican. Why wouldn't he at this point? As he said, he's doing very well as a Republican candidate. He's leading in all these polls, both statewide and nationally. And the even for somebody with the resources that he has, qualifying for ballots in all those states is a long and time-consuming process, I think he's going to, and we've been told that he's telling others that he's going to sign, and I think he will because he thinks it'll automatically boost him up another 10 points, and if he wants to try to answer Jeb Bush's attack, one way to do it is to sign the pledge. If he doesn't sign it, he plays right into Jeb's hands.
Let's hear Jeb Bush a little bit up against Trump. This was on Fox News yesterday. He's talking about his track record as governor of Florida. He wants to tackle America's big issues. Jeb Bush.
We can cut taxes and reform our regulatory system, embrace the energy revolution, fix a broken immigration system, challenge the notion that we can't touch the entitlement system to preserve and protect it. We have to do all those things, and it requires leadership rather than appealing to people's anger.
Lisa, there's Jeb Bush, who was supposed to be the anointed one on the Republican side. How do you see him faring here? There seems so much headwind, and Donald Trump calls him low energy, and it somehow seems to stick.
Well, Donald Trump really has shown a remarkable ability for identifying other people's weaknesses and jumping on them. He's like a heat-seeking missile for your candidates' biggest weaknesses, and he'll say things that, you know, other candidates might have said in a more coded fashion. And that's exactly what worried Bush's strategists. They felt that they couldn't let these attacks go unanswered, and they had to, it was making Bush seem weak, and they had to respond. But of course, there's some risk with this strategy. And I think the biggest one is it's not at all clear whether it will be successful. You know, Trump's appeal isn't based on having some big policy platform about the direction of the country. It's based sort of on a gut feeling and an anger in the electorate, like we were detailing before. So it's not clear if attacking him for flip-flopping on positions and on his party is going to be all that effective. So I think that is a big risk for Jeb's campaign with this strategy.
Howard, you know, where does the GOP establishment strike back, the empire strike back, if that's what's is going to happen here? I mean, they're flipping out over Donald Trump talking about higher taxes. There are a lot of Republican strategists saying, you know, we're being our boat is being stove in here by his alienation of Latino voters long term. If there's going to be a pushback, how does it come? Where? When?
Well, I think the question is whether there is such a thing as a Republican establishment for the purposes of presidential campaigns. I mean, there clearly is one on the Hill. It's run by Mitch McConnell and John Boehner. It's under attack all the time, but it is the establishment. It controls the rules for the most part and gets unity some of the time. But presidential politics on the Republican side, and indeed in the country as a whole, has changed. There is no one who and no group of people who can enforce an edict who can put the genie of Donald Trump back in the bottle. It just doesn't exist. And if the Bush family, which has produced a senator and then a president and then a son who is a president and now is looking at Jeb as the next part of that family dynasty, if he's at 5% in the polls, where's the establishment? I don't think there is one.
Establishment, forget about it. You're writing about disruption recently,
right.
And Kanye West saying he'll run in 2020. Bob, in Clearwater, Florida. Bob, you're on the air with Howard Fineman and Lisa Lehrer.
Hi, Tom. Say, you know, there's a lot of talk about populist candidates and how they are the lightning rod for the public, and they seem to surge in the polls. But truth of the matter is when these outsiders from Washington get into Washington, they find that they're in a whole different stream of fish that they're running in. In order to get things done, it isn't the same thing as running a campaign with jingoism. You know, we saw in the Jimmy Carter administration was a popular candidate, had a very difficult time getting legislation passed. So I think by contrast, and then we're very, very early in the campaign stage, although it sells a lot of press and airtime and boosts reporters' careers, we're not really talking about a possibility of maybe a real viable candidate that's simply populist.
Bob, I appreciate your call. Howard Fineman, you say disruption is the way to go in American politics these days. Bob in Florida looks at that and sees jingoism and maybe ineffectual government once, whether, you know, if one of these outside candidates would actually pull it off.
Well, I think to some extent, one of the reasons for the anger, one of many, and I wouldn't say it's the top one, but one of the reasons is that President Obama ran as a fundamental change agent. He ran as a guy saying, look, I'm by definition outside of the system. I'm going to come in and bring a new spirit of bipartisanship that's going to make Washington work. He's achieved a lot, not the least being it looks like the Iran deal is done, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but he hasn't changed. He hasn't changed the ability of Washington to operate. The Congress can't even do its basic function, which is to pass a budget, et cetera, et cetera. You can go on and on and on. And I think periodically in our country, we have these moments of revulsion with the system as it exists, and we try to reform it. And the question now to me is, I don't think Trump ultimately is that person. But I think he does bespeak a desire to really reform things in the country. A lot of things are wrong. Everybody knows that. And this happens once a generation or so, and it's out there somewhere. I don't know how it's going to come together, but the disruption is real, and I would say necessary. The piece I wrote the other day in the Huffington Post argued that, you know, the U.S. political system, so ossified and dysfunctional, is like a company that is in need of disruption. You know, that became a big term in Silicon Valley. It still is one.
But wasn't Barack
Where's the
Obama's,
disruption in American it, politics?
Wasn't Obama yes. supposed to be the disruption, the change?
Yes, he was, but his achievements notwithstanding, it doesn't feel like that, does it?
Not No, it doesn't. Lots of reasons for that. But right. to our caller's point, one of the reasons been people throwing themselves across the road in front of him and saying,
"Of course, no. Republicans obstructed him at every turn." I'm not blaming him really. I'm just saying that he was promising something that turned out to be extremely difficult to deliver, and we don't have a sort of benign, I believe, benign, optimistic figure such as Barack Obama. The next person people might turn to is a sort of angry authoritarian like Donald Trump.
Maybe. Ron in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Ron, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Just a quick question. Do you suppose the big donors are rethinking the strategies? We've got the candidates up there that are not, you know, from the Beltway. And I don't know if this is correct, but I read a piece last night where the Koch brothers have pulled everything from their poster child, Scott Walker, and I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I'm just wondering what your panel thinks. That, you know, hey, they had it all planned out already, and now the populace is pretty upset, and it shows with Donald Trump and some of the other candidates.
It's a great question, Ron. Let us pick it up. Lisa Lara, what about it? Big money donors and their strategy now, Ron asks. The whole idea of just buying it and charting it out from a gold-plated cockpit somewhere so far doesn't seem too effective. Where's the money going? What does it mean that it hasn't so far been determinative?
Well, it's an interesting thing, right? Because one of the worst things, if the Republican Party wants to get Donald Trump out of the race, I think one of the worst things that could happen would be a bunch of donors would form a super PAC and start running ads against him, right? That you do get the feeling that would just fuel his rise. So it's not exactly clear where donors go. But look, a guy like Ben Carson has a ton of money. He's been a very successful fundraiser. It's largely come from small donations. Same thing for Bernie Sanders. So these guys are fueling their campaigns. They're just not doing it with the kind of traditional big money. Obviously, money will get more important as we move into this primary season. Some of these states are more expensive to run ads in. Super PACs will start getting involved, and they can have a big presence. But it is an open question for, you know, where does the money go? And I think a lot of donors are giving to several candidates. They're putting their eggs in multiple baskets because they just don't know on the Republican side who's going to come out ahead.
What about the dynamic of big money in this race, Howard? The Koch brothers maybe pulling their support for Scott Walker. Where do they go, and do they stay in the game if it doesn't seem so clear, the cause and effect?
Well, I have to say that I'm amused by it, because the one thing that the Koch brothers did not figure on was an other billionaires getting in the race themselves.
Yeah.
They thought they were buying somebody.
Yeah.
And in the world in which that the Supreme Court has created, in which, you know, billionaires stomp across the landscape like mastodons, you know, before the meteors, now you've got a guy who does have one populist argument to make, that he's the one person who can take on the billionaires because he's a billionaire himself, that's an only in America argument that we could be having, leave it to us to figure out how to make it all about the money.
No kidding. Claire in Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Your guests all your guests have been right. People are angry in this country, but there is such a huge difference, Tom, between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a loose cannon. Bernie Sanders, whom I have seen speak twice, fires up the crowd. He's exciting. Yes, there's anger, but he has solutions, Tom. And to assume that Hillary is the anointed one in the Democratic Party is a huge mistake on the part of mainstream media, because I think Bernie has what it takes to go all the way. But unlike Donald, he's got answers, not just bluster.
We're not assuming anything about Hillary Clinton, certainly not at this point, Claire. Let's listen to a little bit of Bernie Sanders. Here he was, South Carolina. Yes, he fires up crowds. That's been very clear. Former Vermont senator talking last month, political revolution.
No one takes seriously the idea that maybe, just maybe, we need a political revolution in America. Maybe, just maybe, something is wrong when almost all of the new income is going to the top 1%.
Bernie Sanders, really firing up the crowd there. He's got lots of agenda items, lots of programmatic changes that he would make. What about this triangle? Not to leave Governor O'Malley out, but Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden. How does that play out, Howard?
Well, we have to see what Joe Biden does. I've been reporting that as closely as I can, and I've known Joe Biden for decades. I think he's torn. I don't know if he's going to do it. If he does do it, I think it'll change the dynamics of the race. It doesn't necessarily mean curtains for Hillary Clinton. He could affect Bernie Sanders' vote, too, in certain respects. But it would certainly change the dynamics of things, and I think it would end Martin O'Malley's concerns about lack of attention to the Democratic race. Suddenly, the Democratic race would be everywhere. But I don't know that he's going to do it. And I agree with the caller that Bernie Sanders is not Donald Trump, in that he has lots of specific proposals, and his is a programmatic way to express the anger through legislation. Donald Trump is playing to the cynicism of the American public about politics, that it can't do anything, that it needs sort of a strong man, quote, manager, unquote, mm-hmm. which is how Trump describes himself. Whereas Bernie ultimately is a believer in the system. He thinks that legislation can do it. The question is whether people will agree with him ultimately.
We heard Martin O'Malley calling him a protest candidate. The suggestion there, Lee, said that, yeah, you can be for Bernie, but there's a limit to how far he can go. In this year, in this campaign season, is that look on the money to you?
I mean, I think Martin O'Malley is in a tough position, right? If you're a Democrat and you're voting with your heart, you're probably voting for Bernie Sanders. If you're voting with your head, you're probably voting for Hillary Clinton. It's not clear where Martin O'Malley fits in this mix. You know, and his background is also he came up as a Clinton Democrat. He was a member of the Democratic Leadership Council. He was very closely aligned with the Clintons. He was one of the first governors to endorse Hillary Clinton. So it becomes a difficult argument.
But
for
what about
to
Bernie?
Make.
How far can he go?
Well, we'll just have to see, right? We don't know. We'll have to see. So far, he's outperformed expectations.
Very high in the latest polls, within range of Hillary Clinton now. And just one more indicator of a kind of wide open, fascinatingly wide open moment in this 2016 campaign season. Lisa Lara with the Associated Press, national political reporter there, joining us from Washington. Great to have you, Lisa. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Howard Fineman, Global Editorial Director, the AOL Huffington Post Media Group. Always wonderful to have you right here, Howard. Thanks for coming
Thank you. It's delightful. Thanks.
Listeners, great to have you with us. You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.